We've just talked about martyrdom and prophecy in the previous segment. Now I want to talk about patronage. We've talked about that a little bit when we were looking at the way the society worked. We'll go a little deeper into it now about patronage and the leadership of women. First of all, what would you say that leadership is? I say it's the ability to get others to change or not to change. There's often a definition that it's an ability to cause change. But I think there's another piece of that. It's also an ability to keep change from happening if change shouldn't happen, you know. So it has to do with change. And at the same time, there's a problem with that because if you think things should continue the way they are, then you want to foster that. But anyway, it's something like that, huh? And we can talk about both formal and informal patronage. Formal patronage has to do with the relationship in the Roman world, the relationship of a former slaveholder to a freedman or freedwoman. And we've talked about that. Remember, it is a formal relationship. It's built into law. And it means that the freedman or freedwoman owes obsequium et operae to the patron. The patron now, the freed person is in the position of client to the patron, and that means honor and reverence and loyalty, and showing up when you're supposed to show up, and also working for free a certain number of days per year by contract for the patron. So that's formal patronage. But for the most part, we're talking about informal patronage. And informal patronage was not built into law. You know, if you're in a situation or a culture in which it's not what you know, it's who you know, you understand a little bit about patronage. It's access to power through others who can get you that access, that context. So, we are talking about a situation in which we have informal leadership in a society that does not have a strong central structure. So, people who have wealth, people who have connections, who can get what they want because they know the right people, they are the ones who exercise patronage. There are certainly political systems today that work on patronage. And many of you may be very familiar with them, and you may be in the midst of them. So it's a question of what connections you have. And so in the Roman world, people would align themselves as clients with someone more powerful than they, who had good connections. And in a society that was as fickle, I would say, as ancient Roman society, you had to align yourself with someone who could protect you. So that the whole society is informally structured that way, so that a whole group of people would be clients of a patron. Now, what did that mean? For the most part, it meant that you showed up at the patron's door very early in the morning, and you waited for a private interview one by one with the patron, and you would hope for answers to your questions. Could I have such and such? Can you give me access to such and such? And you hope for a positive answer. And also there was a custom of handing out little sportulae, was the name for it, little baskets with food in them. And so you hope that you're getting one. And if you really score, you're getting an invitation to dinner that evening. So often in the houses of wealthy patrons, there would be dinners in which certain invited clients would come, and then you'd have all this vying for which place am I going to be assigned to at the table. We've talked about that before. So all of this is involved in the normal function of the way the patronage system worked. In the case of male patrons with elite status, you're also talking about access to political appointments and political positions. It could get very political. Women, of course, were not directly involved in the political system, but they were still involved in informal ways. They could exercise this influence as patrons. So, we have men patrons and we have women patrons. One of the best known of the women patrons was Livia, who was the wife of Augustus. She had her own home, her own household, and she ran her own patronage system. If you couldn't get to the emperor, you got to the empress, to the wife, and you'd try to get her then to intercede for you with not only her husband, the emperor, but with all kinds of other imperial agents that she had access to. So that gives you some sense of how the patronage structure worked, but it also had a trickle-down effect. That is, it wasn't only something that the elite did, it was something that worked on every level. Anybody who had the wherewithal to gather a group of clients around them did. And the clients then would expect access to various things. I've talked before about the function of the house church of networking. Well, that's just an extension of the patronage system, because one of the things that you might want is access to other people who could get you where you wanted to go. And that's what I mean by networking. And that happened really at every level. So we have patrons and clients. And one of the things that's noted in the literature that is produced by people who were influential patrons, and we're talking now about the elites, they tended to avoid the term client. Patron, yes, they're patrons. They tend not to speak of their clients as clients, it's a Latin word, because that was considered demeaning. And the word that they tended to use instead was friend, amici. So a patron and his friends. Did people who were patrons also have friends, real friends? Yes, they did, of the same social status. So it's a tricky thing to interpret when you read this. My own thinking is that just take this off as a little diversion. In the Gospel of John, in the Last Supper discourse, when Jesus says, "I no longer call you slaves, but friends," in a non-patronage society, we tend to interpret the friends there as equals. I don't think that's what's intended at all. I think this is a patron-client language. So that it's from slave. What's the next up from slave? It's client. The freed person, client. So I don't think Jesus is saying there, "I'm treating you on an equal basis," because in John's gospel, nobody's equal to Jesus. Come on. I think the it's a reference there out of the system that you are now my freed person, and therefore you have a different relationship to me, and we're going to operate this in terms of patron and client. Anyway, back to the general considerations here. We're dealing here with patrons and clients. And I've already said, what is the next point here, that the formal relationship requires this reverence and various times of work. I have two pictures here of well-known women patrons. And the first one is this woman named Eumachia. Eumachia was an elite woman, a woman of high status in Pompeii. And one of the things I haven't said is that patrons, wealthy patrons, could also be patrons of associations, professional associations, religious associations, churches. Eumachia is a patron of the Fullers Guild. The Fullers are the people who clean your woolen garments. You know, it's like the dry cleaners. And they have a professional guild, a professional association in Pompeii, as people of the, with the same work did all over in Roman cities. And they had Eumachia as their patron, which meant that she put up a lot of money for them. They had a building, well-located building, right on the forum, the central area, with an inscription at the top that said who they were. This was their guild office. This is where they hung out, you know. And Eumachia is the one who is honored there with a statue. So this is the statue. This is a copy of the original, which is in the museum, of course. But this is the statue of Eumachia, and she is portrayed here as a Roman matron. She wears a simple tunic that goes all the way down to her ankles, but then over that she's wearing a stola. Can you see? It's a very long piece of material, and it goes over her head, and it's wrapped all around her, and it's under her right arm. The stola is the feminine counterpart of the man's toga, a Roman citizen's toga. So it's a long piece of wool that wraps around you, and she's wearing it in the traditional way. So she is depicted here as a Roman matron. We know that that Eumachia also had an extensive burial lot, and this is something that's kind of interesting too with regard to households, that on the way out, one of the roads out, the cemeteries were always outside the city, and therefore as soon as you went out the city gate, the whole road is lined with cemetery. And she had a very extensive plot there, which was a place of burial not only for her immediate family, but also for her freed persons and the slaves in the household. That was one of the good things about belonging to one of these extended households, is that you were guaranteed a place to be buried when you died. So you see that in terms of patronage. You know, she's the one who takes care of everybody. That's the idea. And I wanted to bring in also the example of Junia Theodora. We do not have a statue of Junia Theodora, but we have an extended inscription, a copy of which was placed in her burial chamber outside the city of Corinth. Junia Theodora was a patron, and not a Christian, but a patron in Corinth. And she came from Lycia in Asia Minor, in western Turkey. And she exercised patronage in Corinth for her homeland people, for anybody from Lycia who came into Corinth, probably on business, looking for business connections, looking for a place to stay, for hospitality, for, okay, I'm here now, help me with the connections that I need. And it's all spelled out in her inscription, which gives us a wonderful idea of how patronage functioned and how women's patronage functioned. In the case of Eumachia, Eumachia had a son, at least one son. She was certainly married at one point, and then she was widowed, and she continued her patronage also as a widow. Junia Theodora, we don't know about her marital status, but presumably she was married at some point. And one more of these women patrons at Perga in southern Asia Minor, southern Turkey. Her name was Plancia Magna. She's a second century patron. Again, she is wrapped up in her stola, and you see the long tunic here. You see how long that was, actually dragged the ground. And then the stola is over her head. It's wrapped around her arms, etc. And the statue base for her is what you see on the left, and in Latin and in Greek it says to the goddess Diana, or Artemis in Greek, of Perga, the patron goddess of the city of Perga, Plancia Magna. So Plancia Magna has dedicated a statue to the goddess, the Roman goddess Diana, the Greek goddess Artemis. They were put together in this city. So that was another thing that patrons did, was civic patronage, paying for statues, for monuments, for public baths, for auditoriums, for various things that would benefit the citizens. So that gives you some idea of how women patrons function. So let's just look at the patronage of women in early Christianity, of what we know. We've already mentioned Phoebe, we've mentioned Nympha, we haven't mentioned yet Tavia. In the letters of Ignatius of Antioch, Ignatius was a bishop of Antioch who was arrested and condemned to death and sent to Rome, probably to be executed in the arena. And on the way, he visits a number of, well, he doesn't visit the house, the churches. The church's delegations come to him in various places because he's under arrest. And one of the women he writes about in one of the letters is a named Tavia, who seems to have the same kind of a function that Phoebe and Nympha did, that is, that she's hosting a house church. So we know of others in early Christianity. We can imagine now Phoebe in the same kind of relationship. She's called a diakonos and a prostatus by Paul. Diakonos we'll deal with another time. But prostatus is the word for patron. And everything we've said now about these other patrons, about Junia Theodora, Eumachia, Plancia Magna, these women, like Phoebe, are not in a position to erect public statues. They're not doing public patronage. They're doing patronage of the Christian community, the way Eumachia did of the Fuller's Guild, of the Professional Guild. And we know of other examples of that, of women who are not Christian, who are patrons of religious groups that meet in their house, of professional groups. So, and it's not only women, it's men too, of course, but we're focusing here on the women. So in all of this, I hope that you get some idea of how patronage functioned. And Paul says that Phoebe is his prostatus, his patron. So that means that he probably accepted hospitality in her house, and that she was very influential in networking for him, in introducing him to people who would be helpful for his mission. All of that is part of how patronage functioned in the society at large, and therefore how it functioned in early Christianity.